Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This pandemic is placing moms and dads at increased risk of parental burnout. Research is telling us that parents who experience burnout are more likely to engage in child abuse and neglect. In her work as director of the UK Center on Trauma and Children, Dr. Ginny Sprang focuses on childhood trauma and violence, and we've invited her to share her observations. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Sprang.
Thank you for having me.
So the headlines out there have been suggesting that social distancing and lockdowns could be causing a surge in child abuse. What are you observing?
Well, I think overall, across the country, reports to child abuse reporting lines are down. The number of investigations are down. But this is occurring in the context of increased social isolation, some pretty significant reductions in the number of home visits and child protection contacts that are occurring due to COVID. So we know that, you know, children at risk or in danger before COVID hit are really still at risk or in danger. We're just not able to identify them or interact with them in the same way. Of course, we're really worried about those who are not on our radar yet, those that we weren't already interacting with, that didn't have healthcare contacts, that didn't have a teacher that was looking out for them or a therapist. These are the really young kids that are not yet school age, those that were yet to be identified. And I think it's really highly unlikely that the risk and the acts of child abuse evaporated with COVID. In fact, I think with parents out of work, with kind of this competing demand of trying to work and teach your children and run the household and the stressors and isolation of COVID that have really prevented extended family members from coming in and helping out, that's only increased the risk of violence in some of these already vulnerable families.
As daycare centers, schools, and non-essential businesses have closed, a lot of parents, many now working remotely, are trying to juggle full-time parenting and homeschooling while also trying to work from home. Many families have experienced layoffs or furloughs, resulting in unemployment, financial insecurity, and uncertainty about future employment stability. Those who do still work outside the home are likely to be working in environments that place them at high levels of personal risk, such as hospitals, clinics, grocery stores, and pharmacies. Are these factors causing more stress in the home environment? Can it turn into abusive behavior?
I think that's a really good question. There's a term we use called the window of tolerance, and it's basically a concept that represents the zone of arousal which a person is able to function within most effectively. And so when people are inside their zone of tolerance, they're really able to, you know, like receive and process and kind of integrate new experiences and new information. And they are able to downregulate, like calm themselves down and respond to the demands of everyday life without too much difficulty. But I think in this situation with COVID, you know, all of those things you just listed create this stress. And sometimes it can be considered traumatic, as we talked about before, or adverse in some way. And this has the effect of kind of pushing people outside their window of tolerance. And that causes people to respond to stress, even minor ones sometimes, with extreme hyperarousal or hypoarousal, that's under-responding. And so with hyperarousal, we see people being more impulsive, being less able to handle their frustrations that can lead to child physical abuse or sexual abuse. And in those cases where people shut down, they have that under-responding or hypoarousal, then we see neglect occurring.
Teachers who are mandated by law to report any signs they see of child maltreatment are trying to monitor kids' safety largely over Zoom these days. Is it more difficult under these conditions for professionals to connect with kids and to be able to tell what's going on with them?
Yes. I mean, that is the dilemma. There are fewer touch points with a student throughout the day. So this thing that we call the safety net for kids, it's the maybe the watchful eye, you could call it, of the education system, mm-hmm. of community partners, bus drivers, neighbors, can really be undermined when kids are isolated at home. So people aren't seeing them. People aren't interacting with them. The people that might be safe people for them to go to if something was going on at home that was a problem, those are all being disrupted and disconnected. I know the teachers that we interact with are working very hard to find those kids that they've lost touch with, that are not able to get on Zoom, that are not able to be present every day because they don't have the bandwidth in their community or the internet connection is only at, you know, dad's work and dad's no longer working. So that's something of great concern, and I do think that does increase danger for kids. The other thing is Zoom only provides this very small vision field. So teachers are saying, you know, hold up your camera and let me see your room, you know, trying to get more perspective on what the child's home life is like. But we also know that privacy is very difficult for children to secure when they're at home. So they're less likely to reach out to a teacher and tell them what's going on. I know even in our own clinic, the ongoing provision of therapy via telemedicine has been jeopardized when kids don't have a safe place to talk candidly. So, you know, you ask parents, you know, can the child have a, you know, a space behind a closed door where they can have their therapy session, but you see family members in the room walking through, sitting next to them. And it is changing our ability to reach out to these kids and provide support for them.
And speaking as a father of six, what about siblings? I mean, siblings can be great, but they have their moments. And so now they're cooped up and not all that well supervised as parents are trying to work. What can you tell us about the dynamics of being a sibling in this this environment?
Well, for some of the more vulnerable families, we often have multiple children in a home with special needs. And so, of course, with COVID, it has really disrupted access to special education services for kids that really needed like that one-on-one that special education provides. And so you may have a parent who's managing multiple children with special needs and, you know, without the regulation and structure of the day that some of these kids are used to, you know, they can be extremely dysregulated at home. And so then they're interacting, they're fighting with their siblings, they're interrupting their siblings, they're becoming very distressed because they sense the disruption and things feel off for them. So the violence between siblings also increases, and it's just one more factor to overwhelm a parent who may have already quite a few challenges before them.
Well, let's follow up on that. We do hear about moms and dads who are feeling parental burnout big time right now. Physical and mental exhaustion, constant worry, trouble getting enough sleep, emotional distancing from their children. What are the dangers in these situations?
So this parental burnout that you're describing, I think combined with COVID and the general uncertainty and the stressors of, you know, not being able to get the things that you need, go the places you would normally go to get support. You know, maybe you can't go to your yoga class anymore. Your mom's day out is closed. Grandparents that would come in and provide respite aren't able to come in. So all of these things kind of push parents outside their window of tolerance. And, you know, we all get pushed outside the window of tolerance, maybe even on a daily basis, but it's short-lived, and we can use all of our good coping skills to get ourselves back in that zone of arousal where we can keep cool. But if it's prolonged, and, you know, right now this has been going on since March with no end in sight, there is a fair amount of uncertainty that overwhelms people, and it's like, how long can I stay outside my window of tolerance and this not turn into something more difficult and damaging to my family.
Are parents' expectations of themselves, what they think they should be doing and achieving as parents, in trouble here? How does this parental disappointment, if they're self-aware and they're feeling it, translate into abuse and neglect of children?
I think that we need to be aware that we're operating under extraordinary conditions. And so we do need to adapt. We need to give ourselves a little bit of a break and not be too hard on ourselves. But at the same time, we need to be cognizant that these added stressors do sometimes become problematic for some. And some people have more difficulties regulating their emotions. They start to have symptoms that kind of undermine their normal adaptation. So we need to be aware and we need to be extra diligent about finding ways that we can downregulate, that we can calm ourselves down. It might be mindfulness, it might be running, it might be through spirituality. There are a range of things that people can select that help them kind of get centered and don't let these circumstances get the best of them. But we have to be very diligent and maybe more explicit than you were in the past about doing these things.
We've been talking mostly about intact family units, and I understand that you have a study underway looking at COVID-related stress in foster families. Can you talk about preliminary findings?
Yes. We do have some findings that are just emerging from this study, and what we're noticing is about 75% of this sample of around 650 foster parents are reporting that COVID has changed their routines in three or more areas of their life. So work, education, socially, their religious life. And, you know, just under about 40% are reporting that they've experienced a loss of in-person or remote contact with their family members. Not all their social supports, but with those family members that they would normally lean on. And we're also seeing some secondary traumatic stress symptoms increase. Secondary stress are those symptoms related to being exposed to the trauma experiences of others. And so for foster families, this is very important because those children in their care have been trauma exposed. So they're hearing about the child's trauma. They're going to court and hearing about it. They're hearing about it from their child protection workers. So they're actually at high risk of developing secondary traumatic stress. In fact, 77% of them are reporting distressing thoughts or feelings about their child's trauma that's lasting more than a month. And about a quarter of them are describing this distress as moderate or extreme and even, you know, impacting their functioning. But one of the symptoms that we're seeing that has increased with COVID is sleep disturbance. That's up about 7%. And of course, we need good, healthy sleep to be able to adapt and regulate in the ways we just talked about. And also, their feelings of being discouraged about the future are up about 5% as well. So we are seeing that COVID is kind of exacerbating some of those symptoms that were there before the pandemic arrived.
What about foster parents? What are they going through?
So those are basically the symptoms that a foster parent is reporting that they're experiencing. So that's not just the child. That is the foster parent that is having those kind of secondary traumatic stress symptoms. And I think that's pretty significant because until recently, foster parents were really underrepresented in the literature in terms of a population that had secondary trauma. So now we're seeing this documented in ways that make them a target for intervention.
What sorts of resources are available out there that can help parents, foster parents, biological parents, alleviate the stress that we've been talking about?
I think that it's important that parents and foster parents recognize if their distress is actually causing an impairment in the way that they're working or they're relating to other people. And if that's prolonged, you know, it's lasted more than a month or so, then it might be a sign that they need a little extra support, that they need to be engaged with activities that will help them self-regulate, that is kind of decrease the amount of stress that they're feeling, some way to adapt in the moment. And if they're having a lot of symptoms, they're not sleeping, they're having intrusive thoughts, these are thoughts that pop in their head about doom and despair and their child's trauma, if they are, you know, feeling like they're re-experiencing some of the symptoms that their child is describing, then they really should reach out to a professional and get a little extra support. It doesn't mean they have PTSD, but it does mean that they have some trauma symptoms that are saying, pay attention to me, and they may need to be addressed.
It can be really helpful to have that dispassionate third-party voice out there who can look at things a little bit more clearly than if you're in the forest and up close to the trees, huh?
Absolutely.
Dr. Jenny Sprang is director of the Center on Trauma and Childhood at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Taking us into our next segment, Lexington's Johnson Brothers. No matter how things turn out on November 3rd, there will be a Now for Something Completely Different opportunity just a few days later. The music of a legend channeled through the talents of artists who live and work among us. It's the Music for Mission Tribute Concert, and in keeping with the times, it will be virtual this year. Joining us to fill you in on who's being honored is the force behind this much-anticipated annual celebration, Anita Courtney. Hi, Anita.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. And for anybody who's hearing about this event for the first time, and as a reminder to those who are aware of it, if you could tell us briefly about this concert series. What's the mission?
Music for Mission is a series that was started by First Presbyterian Church about 11 years ago. They typically have four concerts a year, and one of them is a tribute to a famous artist, where we put out a call to local artists to send in any songs they want from that artist catalog. We have a committee that then puts together the concert, just looking for just the right mix of songs and styles and variety. And the way it's set up is sponsors pay the musicians. The tickets are free to the audience, and they're asked to make a donation to four nonprofits that all get sort of put under this umbrella for Music for Mission. So those nonprofits are Greenhouse 17, Glean Kentucky, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, and the Central Music Academy. So it's a nice format that allows a lot of people to be generous and a lot of people to get to enjoy a really unique concert where musicians are just pouring their hearts and souls and time and talent into great catalogs of songs. So it's a really great event.
In the past, you've honored Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan. Tell us who you're paying tribute to this year.
This year, it is John Lennon. It marks the 80th anniversary of his birth, the 40th anniversary of his death. And in this time of such political unrest, he seemed like the perfect person to honor because he used his fame for good, for political activism, to stand for peace, and it seemed like a good fit for this year. And his music is both accessible and mind-blowing. I think people will be singing along, they'll have a lot of memories, and he is just such a cultural icon. It seemed like the right time to honor him.
In the past, these concerts have taken place live before a packed house in the First Presbyterian Church in Lexington, and a shout-out to Marlon Hurst. He's Director of Music and Arts at First Presbyterian. This year, with this pandemic and social distancing and everything else that's going on, we'll be able to watch and listen from home, watching in bed, would be totally appropriate, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, how are you making this happen? Tell us about the mechanics of it.
Anagram Sound, who is Chris Wheeler, is and his team came into the church last week and filmed each artist in that beautiful church with the great acoustics. He has a great soundboard and a great team, and we were COVID safe every step of the way. We waited 3 hours between each recording session. Everybody had to get a COVID test before they could perform. So this has already been filmed, and it's in the process of being put together. The sound is being worked, and we'll also hear 60-second shout-outs from the nonprofits about their work. So it's going to be a great show, just a little over an hour, and I think the community is going to really enjoy it.
And who's performing?
We have 21 different artists. Do you want to hear all the names?
Is there a list online that people can go to?
There is a list online. And in fact, we have a biography of these 21 artists on the First Presbyterian Church website. And that is fpclex.org/M4M. That stands for Music for Mission. And you can click on that site and you'll see the list of the great artists we have. And what's been great is a lot of these artists are collaborating for the first time just for this show. So there's some great combinations of well-known musicians around town coming together for the first time to just have a joyride with John Lennon songs.
So I mentioned a bed-in, and you're actually recreating that famous 1969 John Lennon and Yoko Ono anti-war protest for all to see. Tell us about that.
Yes, we are. So as you said, in 1969, when John Lennon and Yoko Ono got married, they knew they were going to get a lot of media attention. So they spent their honeymoon in bed-ins to speak out for peace and invited the media from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. for a week in each location. So we'll be reenacting that at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center on Halloween, October 31st, from 3 to 7 p.m. Two of our musicians, Melissa Snow Groves and David Hurst, her husband, are going to be in the window of the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center. And so people will be able to stand on little circles on the sidewalk, socially distanced, and view the bed-in. And there'll be John Lennon music wafting on the sidewalk. Alfalfa Restaurant next door will have lemon bars, but we're calling them Lennon bars. So it should be a really fun thing to do on Halloween.
Oh, gosh, we sure could use some fun these days. Thanks for doing that. So tell us just the details. When is the concert happening? How can we get the link to watch and listen? And is there an admission fee?
The concert is on November 6th at 7:30 p.m. It's going to be on Facebook Premiere. You can look up the link at the same site that I mentioned earlier, www.fpclex.org/M4M. There is not an official admission fee, so everyone is welcome to come. And that is one advantage of this virtual concert, that before we could only have 450 people, and now it's unlimited. There's no cost for the tickets, but we're asking for people to make donations to the Music for Mission organization that we can then dispense to the four nonprofits. We're also encouraging people just to really make a night of it, to set up a date night or a group watch, wear your Lennon outfit, as you said, have a bed-in, sing along with us on Imagine. So though we can't be together, it's still an opportunity just to have a lot of fun.
That's Anita Courtney, who makes this wonderful event happen for us every year. We thank you so much, Anita.
Thank you, Tom.
And we're going to go out with a sampling. Lexington jazz pianist Raleigh Daly performing a Lennon song that is just as powerful and maybe even more relevant today as it was when it was released in 1977. Imagine. Coming up after the break.
It's time for the United States to also navigate its atrocities over African Americans and Native Americans. And we have not ever done this. And the bill has indeed come due.
What deep history tells us about our current circumstances with UCLA Egyptologist Kara Cooney. And
that as many as 60% of young people have an idea or goal of starting their own business in the future. So we want to help them do that.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
After more than a year in bankruptcy court, coal company Black Jewel now says it's ready to exit bankruptcy by the end of the year. But environmental advocacy groups worry that the plan will leave Kentuckians on the hook for what's left behind. Sydney Bowles reports.
Black Jewel declared bankruptcy in the summer of 2019. Most of its coal mining permits have been sold. But about 40 of them in eastern Kentucky haven't sold. And that means there's no one to pay to restore the environmental damage left by mining. The court is now considering a liquidation plan that includes a reclamation trust fund with an estimated $40 million in bonds to cover the cost of environmental repairs. That's from an analysis by the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, an advocacy group. Under the plan, the coal mining permits would be extinguished. But documents filed in the case show that regional advocates worry that $40 million won't be enough to repair the damage left behind. And the citizens groups are concerned that the bankruptcy arrangement will mean citizens won't have recourse to sue if the reclamation work doesn't happen. The permits at issue are estimated to cover 11,000 acres. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Forgive me for this. I know you've often heard this repeated, but the more things change, the more they really do remain the same. You discover that when you take a deep, deep dive into human history. That's the territory of archaeologists, the profession of our Future Tense host, Chris Begley, as well as his latest guest.
Today on Future Tense, I'm excited to welcome Egyptologist Kara Cooney. She's a professor of Egyptian art and architecture at UCLA and the author of When Women Ruled the World, Six Queens of Egypt. She also hosted the TV series Out of Egypt. And this is the first time that I've had another archaeologist on the show. So welcome, Karen. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, you study the 21st dynasty in Egypt, probably among other things. Now, that is the first dynasty of a period after the New Kingdom when things had declined and fallen apart. And in reading some of the things you've written, you know, one of the interesting things was it had gotten so bad, the supply chains were disrupted and resources were depleted that they were reusing coffins. When I read that, that sounds a little bit like you could be talking about the 21st century. And I wanted to ask you about some similarities you might see, you know, now that we're in this situation with the kinds of stuff you look at as an archaeologist.
Yeah, I think that the reuse of coffins hits you pretty hard. And you're like, wait a minute, they went into a burial, took out a body, took the coffin out and updated it like you would update a kitchen or a bathroom. And they did do that. But I think the main point to hit on is that collapse is already here for 90% of Americans who can't get, who have to get in line at the DMV at a certain time to get their driver's license, or who can't get unemployment benefits, who are freaking out about life when they break an arm and they get a $50,000 bill. But when collapse hits the top of society, that's when things get interesting. And that's what this information, this data that I'm dealing with about coffin reuse is showing that the wealthy are experiencing just as much deprivation and trauma as the poor had been ostensibly for generations, but now they're dealing with it as well. And it's so typical that the wealthy like to just continue to do what they've always done. So they don't create a new religious perspective on what to do with the coffins. They don't think, you know, we need to come up with some new rituals, some other ways. They just keep doing the same thing, banging their head against the brick wall and keep using the same polychrome painted coffins and displaying their family power in that way. And because they're unwilling to relinquish that method of display, they have to find another way to do it if they can't get the wood, if they can't get other resources. And so coffin reuse skyrockets. And for the 21st dynasty, the rate of reuse with just what I can see with my two eyes and a flashlight goes above 60%. And I guarantee you, if I was able to run these things through CT scans and x-rays, that number would go way higher. So it's a communal agreement of rich people who are all highly affected by this government and trade and economic collapse, all agreeing to let's just do the same things that we did before.
And that's interesting, thinking about what part of society is really affected when, you know, in these transitions. Now, I first talked to you a few months ago for a book project that I'm doing focused on societal collapse, looking at how things change. And, you know, many people now wonder if we're headed in that direction. And one of the things that for me has been sort of eye-opening, really looking into this, is how different these collapses or these declines or these transformations in the past were from how we portray them or how we think about them. And I wondered if you might talk about that. What would you expect to see right now, for instance, if we were in the midst of undergoing something like you see archaeologically?
I think the hardest thing to see is a long duration of time, a deep time. We're so, especially now, in the moment, doom scrolling on Twitter, looking at, you know, the latest person to have gotten COVID in the White House or whatever it is happening in the moment. And it's hard to understand that collapse doesn't just take a generation, but multiple generations. And it happens in different stages. And that one stage of a collapse might be, it might seem like the ultimate of excesses, a kind of decadence, deprivations in overconsumption and social inequality that everyone knows are different from what had come before. Their cultural memory tells them this, that there shouldn't be so few people so wealthy and everyone else suffering so much. But the frenzy for those wealthy people, it just seems to, the competition amongst them seems to increase the consumption. And it's astounding to see how human beings can sense collectively that the collapse is coming and yet not do anything about it, because the system locks in that we go over the cliff, but not all is won. We send our forward advanced poor people over the cliff first, the immigrants, the unwanted, the others. And then the people who've been running the society, they hold on to the last gasp. They will go over eventually, but it seems like they've got it all together. And even to themselves, they can tell themselves an alternative narrative that everything's fine until the last minute. And I'd say you could see this in Rome, ancient Rome, those years of the 3rd century, even the 4th century, for the very wealthy, these excessive celebrations and potlatches, if you like, these ways of showing one's wealth. And you can see it in Egypt as well. And I would say it's during the reign of Ramses II when you see the most excess and the most production of tombs and coffins and statuary and really nice things, not as nice as what you had before, but you have a lot more production happening. And it takes in each case another 50 to 100 years for the rich people to go over the cliff too. And even then, with the systems in hand, if you're able to maintain just a part of the system intact, then those haves at the top of society can often still wield those institutions to their benefit and keep things going. So one could argue, and you know this as well, that no collapse is ever total. You keep things going. Even an asteroid that hit the Earth didn't kill all the mammals. You know, we get some little shrews that survive and turn into humans, even though all of their life is removed for years. Nothing's ever completely obliterated. Even an archaeological site, if you want to destroy something, you leave chunks of stone or statues or something there for archaeologists to find. So there's always going to be some remnants of society that can just hold on and then wait out the tough time period, wait out the economic deprivation, and then wait for that economic upswing, and then manipulate the collapse and the cultural memory of the hard times to their favor and tell everyone, if you don't want to go through something like that again, you want to work with me or vote for me or follow me or whatever it is. So these collapses can also be very, very useful fodder for those in power who are able to maintain themselves over generations.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, I know you see and I see as an archaeologist too, is that these collapses are much slower than we imagine, much more gradual, and really have these roots much deeper than we imagine. You know, in thinking about what we're seeing right now, you know, if I were to look at this and look back to say, when was it that this sort of decline began? You know, you might go back to the, I don't know, to the 1970s with the rise of, you know, neoliberal capitalism, or you might go back to some other, you know, the tax cuts of the Reagan era or something that really ultimately, you know, the payment came due, but it was much later. And that's what we see here.
And that's not far enough, because if you're really thinking in terms of deep time and you're really trying to figure out where the human race went off the rails, then I would go back to one of two points. You can either go to the Industrial Revolution and start to see that massive amount of technological ability and growth without the concomitant cultural connection to what was happening. But you could also go back to the Agricultural Revolution itself, go back a good 10,000 years and see when human beings started to impose power structures on other people, when social inequality became the law of the land, when laws themselves were created, when the institution of marriage was created, when morality was created. Before that, humanity was a very different beast. And it did grow, but not with the impunity that it would take on with the agricultural revolution. The agricultural revolution, it takes a very dynamic spectrum of human sexuality and makes it a binary of male and female. It makes the females subservient to the males. It makes the children subject to corporal punishment in a way they hadn't been before. And I'm not trying to romanticize hunter-gatherer life, because it was a pretty difficult and horrific existence where people are mostly going to die before the age of 30 and a whole band of people can die out from starvation. It's not an easy thing, but it's a different kind of society. So if you're looking at where human beings sowed the seeds for what's happening now, where we're talking about the destruction of the planet itself, if we look at things in a really larger scale, then I would go back to 10,000 BCE and look to Çatalhöyük and places like that.
Yeah, the beginning of sedentary lifestyle, living in one place, accumulation of wealth, and all of the inequalities, you know, in terms of distribution of wealth and power that we have there.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking now at what you have seen happen, you know, thinking about it, the short time, the last 5 months, 6 months, what are some of the significant changes or developments that you have seen during the pandemic that you think really could signal a change?
I think that Americans in particular have a love affair with the collapse that happens wholly outside of themselves, such that an asteroid hits the Earth. We make movies about things like that, or a pandemic hits and it's out of our control and I didn't do it. You know, we're just subject to the whims of these forces, an act of God. And I think that the globalized world that we now have around us enables us to see that you can be hit by a so-called act of God and react very differently as a human, organic, mega species of many in Germany or New Zealand versus the United States or Britain or Canada, for that matter. And you can see how some systems are very resilient and able to cope. Yes, people die. Yes, lives are lost. Yes, life changes and the economy suffers. But some places do much better than other places. And I think all of us are considering those things, even those people who are dug into more authoritarian patterns. And in authoritarianism, interestingly, it's not really on the spectrum here, because China, even though maybe the virus started there, it has done pretty well with controlling that virus through authoritarianism. Places with authoritarian personalities, like the United States or Britain right now on the upswing, are not doing as well. So it's a different kind of social structure, and I think it's forcing people to look at systems in a way they hadn't before, and it makes them question exceptionalism, question things that they had all together, question the idea that if you're technologically superior, like we are in the United States, if your system still sucks, it's all going to break apart. It doesn't matter if you can solve the pandemic in a lab. If you can't distribute that solution, then you are nowhere. And so I think everyone's thinking about a better government that serves everyone, and that this idea of socialism being evil is very much being reconsidered. Maybe we'll resurrect it, but call it by a different name.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of what you've pointed out there with the authoritarianism as a problem in one case and not in another might have to do with sort of the amount of polarization that you have, political polarization and the delegitimizing of the other side that's part of the reaction, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there things that you're seeing that make you hopeful for the future? And, you know, when things change, they can change for the better.
Yeah, in the same way that suddenly 60-65% of Americans were like, you know, gay people deserve to be able to get married, and that changed on a dime quite quickly, and you saw a punctuated equilibrium movement of public opinion on that topic, I think that you're seeing a movement of public opinion on many different things. And I'm not just talking about gender and sexual identity, though that's certainly associated with power, but these ideas of how many in a society get to participate. Like, just let me give you an example in Los Angeles, where we're dealing with homelessness that is off the charts, where you turn the corner and there's another tent city and another tent city. And you can, as some people do, blame their congressmen, blame their council leaders, blame the government. And in some ways you would be right, but I think that 60-65% of Americans are now realizing that individuals have much less power than they thought they did, and scapegoating can only go so far, and that it's not one councilman's fault that there's a bunch of homeless people on their corner, that it has to be something that's much broader base than that. And I see people moving towards a socialism, or at least a government that serves all, in a way that they haven't for some time. And as we have to pay $2,000 a month for insulin if you're a diabetic, and these things are hitting upper middle class people in a way that they haven't before, or the middle class in the United States, I think people are realizing that if we don't take care of all of society in some way, instead of just pull yourself up by your bootstraps individualism, then you will be nowhere. And so many of the mythologies of the United States, number one, it's individualist, free market winning over all. I think that exceptionalism is blowing up, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And number two, the idea that the United States was based on freedom instead of being based on the exploitation of Black bodies is something that is being heavily reconsidered by people all around us. And it is no mistake that in the middle of the pandemic and authoritarian personalities presidency, that we see all of these discussions happening at once. That's not to say some people aren't very against it and put up their own cerebral barriers and refuse to hear what other people are saying. But a massive society is now talking about things and recognizing things that they did not see before. So now you can go out and start talking about redlining with somebody, and they'll know what you're talking about. You tried that 10 years ago, and people are like, wait, what, redlining? Oh, Black people can buy houses. Sure they can. And you're like, no, there's a system set up. But now people know what that is. Or you go out and you talk to somebody about how we subsidize soybeans and cheap filler foods. And I remember having a big argument with this about my ex-in-laws. And they're like, no, they subsidize vegetables. I'm like, no, they don't. And government food bills are now being discussed by populations in a way with more education and more intelligence than one would expect of a society that is so laden with conspiracy theories. So it's interesting the way the two are going along with each other, right? They're going hand in hand.
Yeah, that laying bare all of these inequities and this history has been presented in other ways, I think, for me too, seems like one of the most important developments that we've seen.
I mean, how does Germany or Japan overcome their wartime past without looking in the face the atrocities that they committed? Germany has shown how well they have been able to navigate that route. It's time for the United States to also navigate its atrocities over African Americans and Native Americans. And we have not ever done this. And the bill has indeed come due.
Well, Kara Cooney, professor of Egyptian art and architecture at UCLA, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
With us now is Bobby Clark, founder and president of the nonprofit Sustainable Business Ventures. And they just landed a new grant to help Kentucky small businesses and entrepreneurs get a leg up in this really tough pandemic economy. Hi, Bobby.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing good. And if you could tell us about this grant that you've landed.
Well, we're so excited about this opportunity. I've been working in the entrepreneur communities for many, many years throughout my career. And one of the things we want to do, because small businesses are really the lifeblood of our economy, and they've been hit hard by the pandemic, is how do we help them deal with the circumstances that they're dealing with in their community?
So the grant, I believe, is for $54,000. Is that correct?
Yes, $54,000, and we're going to help connect small business to on-demand training, coaching, and help and survival and thrive. And there's many organizations that people don't know about, like Mountain Association in Berea and SOAR throughout the Appalachia. And these organizations want to help small businesses, and we want to help connect them to the small businesses throughout the Commonwealth.
So how do you get started with this project? What's first?
Well, the first step is we convene local community members, the elected officials, the chamber president, the bankers, the community leaders, and faith-based leaders, is get everybody together to begin a process of mapping out a plan on how they can help grow businesses in their community.
And as I understand it, Bobby, the idea is to establish what you're calling entrepreneurial communities in Kentucky. What's an entrepreneurial community?
An entrepreneurial community was first laid out by the Center for Rural Entrepreneurship. It developed a game plan on how to look differently at economic development in rural communities. And that process is a way to engage and get people excited to develop an entrepreneurial mindset and looking at small businesses in a way, and also how do you get other businesses started in your community?
Which counties are you targeting for this?
We are targeting the 8 Jackson Purchase area counties in far west Kentucky, and we have 8 in eastern Kentucky: Breathitt, Lee, McGoffin, Elliott, Menifee, Morgan, Rowan, and Wolf counties. And even though we're focusing on those counties, this is a statewide organization, and we want any business anywhere in the Commonwealth to get engaged in this process so we can help them grow or survive.
And how about young people that might have an entrepreneurial streak and they're just beginning to develop it? Are you open to student involvement?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the 10 steps of developing an entrepreneurial community is focusing on youth development. We want to get high school students. We want to get college students engaged in the process. What's happening in many rural communities is there are very few jobs. And so when young people get out of high school, they either go to college or they have to leave their community because there are not any jobs. And so we want to change that and get them excited. In fact, one study I read is that as many as 60% of young people have an idea or goal of starting their own business in the future. So we want to help them do that.
So somebody hears this and they want to learn more. How can they do that?
Well, they can call me at 859-227-0263. or they can go up to our website, www.sbventures.org. And there's information there for them to look at this. It costs nothing to join our entrepreneur network. And one of the things that I describe about our network is like we're a LinkedIn network on steroids. Not only do you have the profiling connectivity capability, but we can have hundreds and thousands of training videos and webinars and how-to to help a business navigate the challenges that they deal with in a day-to-day basis on their business.
That's Bobby Clark, founder and president of the nonprofit Sustainable Business Ventures. Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you.
Kentucky's Secretary of State, Michael Adams, is urging voters to take advantage of early voting ahead of November 3rd. As WFPL's Jess Clark reports, Adams says it'll help the election run more smoothly.
Because of the pandemic, the state has expanded opportunities for people to cast their votes ahead of Election Day. Secretary of State Michael Adams says in order to prevent stress on election resources, he's hoping voters will be fairly evenly split in how they cast their ballots, with a third using absentee, a third voting early, and another third voting on Election Day.
Elections this year is a three-legged stool. If you put too much stress on one leg, you're going to snap it.
Speaking to the Louisville Rotary Club, Adams urged people to vote early. Early voting is already underway in Jefferson County, with four polling stations open Monday through Saturday, 8:30 to 4:30 through November 2nd. I'm Jess Clark in Louisville.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Have a topic for us to consider? We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.